Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That, friends, was the voice of Brian Brown, creator of the Brown Briefly. Every week, as you know, we try to live up to his high standards of hosting a discussion of current events laced with empathy, intelligence, humor, and, of course, progressive persuasion. Although Brian's concept was less is more or less, in reality, we never really got enough of Brian's presence in our lives. So again, this week, we're really blessed with some of this Brieflies joining you, as well as a new friend joining us today. So, hey, who's here? Former airline pilot, treetop landing aficionado, recovering back surgery patient, and West Texas devotee Truman O'Brien. Good morning, Truman.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good to see you. We also have historian, skipper of the Vashona, president of the Vashon Heritage Museum, and guardian of the galaxy, Bruce Hallman, is with us today. Hello, Bruce.
Hi, good to be here.
Likewise, good to have you. Also joining us today, so many accomplishments, too little time to list, but an advocate, arbitrator, mediator, and Fulbright specialist, not to mention former Washington State Assistant Attorney General, Craig Bellisk. Always good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to see all of you. Thanks.
And thank you, our special guest this week on Small Talk, Amy Carey of Sound Action. Good morning, Amy. How are you this morning?
Good morning. I'm doing fine, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
We look forward to you joining us. Mine is the voice of Kevin Jones, Indivisible Vachon, Vachon Climate Action Group, and collectively we strive to create a livable planet overseen by a government we can all appreciate or at least tolerate. And we're going to talk a little bit about government tolerance later in the show, hopefully we'll share some perspectives on that. But hey, let's dive right in by inviting a moment of introspection about our Vachon world, or what's your most pleasant surprise from last week's election? Truman, what are your thoughts?
Well, you mean the red ripple that came
Isn't
across?
Isn't that a beverage?
Yeah, it sounds like it, yeah. Yeah, I was really actually surprised. I mean, very surprised at the outcome. I don't think anybody was ready for that. But, I mean, places that you just would not think of going blue went blue. So, anyway, that's my surprise for the week.
All right. Hey, Bruce, what's your perspective? I know we commented on this upcoming election just last week when it was happening. What are your thoughts today?
Well, it's a good indication of how divided we are and how closely we divided we are as a nation, you know, and yet how some basic principles are still at work. And I think, you know, individual women's choice played a very important part of this. You know, sort of the craziness of the far right and the election deniers played a big part of it. And so my sense is, I was reading an article, I think in the New York Times, talks about one of the aspects of the times we live in is calcification. We're really locked into where we are in positions. And there's very little sort of movement. And the movement is in the center and always has been. And the center is very narrow. But what you saw this past week is that narrow center did not want to go way to the right to the crazies. And so I'm encouraged, but still a long way to go.
Yes. All right. Hey, and Craig, of course, this, you know, anything introspection about Vachon or the election or what's on your mind?
Yeah, you know, my feel on the election, obviously, as I think was just pointed out by Bruce, women did play a huge part in the Democrats prevailing on many fronts, and young voters came through really for the first time in mass, which made a big difference. The one disappointing thing was the whole New York vote, where many of the Congress districts were flipped, which was unfortunate. But being a progressive, I was happy to see that the Dems retain control of the Senate, which means they control the appointment of judges.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And being of judicially minded yourself, that's got to be a relief.
It is.
Yes. Amy, any thoughts you'd like to share with us about your what's going on with you and Vashon and Maury Island or the election? What's top of mind for you?
I think everybody's been, you know, the election has been the big thing this past week, and I am grateful the way it turned out. And I think I read this somewhere that there wasn't a red wave, there was a row wave. I think that's very true. And so it still, too, I think does clearly show how divided we are, where there are issues, but not necessarily on Roe, just in general. But I'm really grateful that, you know, we are at that platform where we can hopefully continue to make some progress and bring change and not go back to the dark ages.
Mm-hmm. And truly dark they were. I would like to mention that Debbie Jackson, who joined us to talk about Vashon to Voters, which is the postcarding group here on the islands, she's gearing up for the Georgia runoff election. Should be no surprise to anybody. If you're not already on Debbie's postcard writing mailing list, you can email her. Her email address, I love it, is active.deb.vash@gmail.com. And I'll come back to that a little bit later so you can catch that on your pen and paper. Also, I do want to mention at the Vashon Maury Community Council meeting next Monday, November 21st, 7 p.m., the council is going to vote on whether they should include a land acknowledgement for their meetings, something that is not currently on their agenda. The resolution, so at any rate, the you can find on their website the opportunity to join that meeting, and as something you can also find on our Indivisible Vashon or Vashon Climate Action Group mailing list, you'd have received a invitation. So if you want to vote and express your views on a land acknowledgement, whether we should or shouldn't at the council, now's next Monday at 7 is a good time. Okay, let's see.
Kevin, can I interject just for a second? I think there's probably some listeners out there who don't know what a land acknowledgement is.
Ah, good point. So a land acknowledgement is a statement of recognition of the fact that the land that we occupy is historically occupied by the indigenous peoples of our country. And it's a recognition of that. Bruce, you are quite an expertise in this area. Maybe you would want to amplify that.
Yeah, it's just simply an acknowledgement that there were people here before us who were removed by us, essentially, by our forebears. And so it's just that sort of recognition that we're on the traditional lands or traditional territories of Native people who were displaced. And it's only the first step in a much longer process of reconciliation and recognition, but it's a start.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else, Craig, on that?
I just thought that some people might not understand what that meant. So.
Yeah, perfect. I should also mention that also at the council meeting, there is a resolution to support the use of the King County and Kipsack County passenger-only boats to supplement the service we're getting right now from Washington State ferries, particularly in the middle of the day when it used to be like less than an hour between boats. Now it can be like an hour and a half between boats. So that resolution is also on the agenda for discussion. So check out the upcoming community council meeting next Monday, November 21st at 7 p.m. And if you want Debbie Jackson's email address, again, active.deb.vash, without the O-N, just vash, @gmail.com. All right. I would like to now jump right into small talk. And we, of course, on our islands, we're surrounded by Puget Sound. Our islands interact with this inland sea in all kinds of ways. We travel to and fro. We recreate on the water. And of course, it's also the basin into which rainwater and anything else that can wash away will drain into. So keeping Puget Sound clean and healthy is an enormous job. Under the leadership of Amy Carey, the former executive director of Preserve Our Islands, Sound Action is our Puget Sound watchdog group working to protect vital nearshore habitat and species. So Amy, thank you again for joining us on Small Talk today.
I'm happy to be here. And I'm going to think there should be a sort of bingo card of when will one of my dogs or cats either bark or something like that. No surprise have to anybody, but yes.
The listener who can call it the closest, we should award a prize.
I'm surprised it has not happened yet, but yeah.
Okay. Well, when my phone rings, I'll be competing with you on distracting noises.
There you go.
Well, hey, Amy, the first thing that comes to mind for me is I wonder if Sound Action evolved from Preserve Our Islands, or was Sound Action a whole new opportunity? And what are your thoughts on that? And how did you come to get involved with this kind of work?
Well, it did evolve from Preserve Our Islands. And as I think folks know, though plenty of people are on the island, probably weren't here when it happened. You know, Preserve Our Islands was an organization that was founded in basically to prevent some very serious environmental damage from a gravel mine proposal that was on Maury Island in an industrial barging operation. And it took about, 15 years. But this small community did what we do very well, and we actually won that fight. And I had started into Preserve Our Islands in the very kind of early days, bringing into some dialogue of the southern resident orcas, which I always joke are my sort of gateway species to environmental habitat protection. And so, and I moved into a role of ultimately being a president and then executive director of Preserve Our Islands, and got the very fun job of getting to navigate through the federal court case we had there that we won. And then when that battle was successful, you know, we had learned as an organization too, both a lot of skill set and know-how on policy, regulatory, law. And what we had really seen up front and center was that the regulatory process was so broken, the permitting process. And the gravel mine was a great example, because that was something that should have never even really had much of a breath of life to it. And instead, at every level, it was getting rubber stamped. And that was something that we were learning wasn't just that sort of project. That's what we see everywhere. And so after we won the Maury Island fight, we had a ginormous party, which was really fun. And then we really recognized that, yeah, we could just go home and sort of, you know, say good job and enjoy our success. But the things that we were fighting so hard for orcas, for salmon, for forage fish, for healthy beaches, that problem was still happening, that death by a thousand cuts everywhere. And there was a real gap. Nobody was really taking that body of work on. And so we spent about a year doing a lot of outreach, talking to legislators, other environmental organizations, all sorts of things, and then launched as Sound Action in 2013 and took our work system-wide. So for the entirety of the inland waters of the Washington State portion of the Salish Sea, and doing a very targeted focus of work on the permitting process, regulatory actions, environmental law application, and have been doing that work exclusively since.
So you go and take a look at the permits that are submitted. What exactly, kind of how does that look in the day of the life of a day of Sound Action?
Depressing, but so as part of our, I'll try to stay on the very high level of regulatory wonk, which I say to folks, like, regulatory process sounds about like the most unsexy thing in the world, but it's really where the rubber meets the road for habitat protection, because if those laws aren't applied, then we're already losing habitat faster than we can do restoration. And so, so when we went to sort of the system-wide approach, we targeted a permit that's called the HPA. It's a permit that's issued at the state level by the State Department of Fish and Wildlife. And we took a focus on that, not only because we knew there were some very big problems with that system, but that every in-water permit requires that HPA. So it was one of the few ways to see literally every project coming into the same sea. And we took the watchdog approach of permit by permit review. And I have the great fun of doing that job. And so about 500 permits a year that we review. And then if they don't do what they're supposed to do, either the agency, Fish and Wildlife, doesn't apply the law appropriately, they're not protecting habitat the way the law is directing them to, and sometimes even smaller sort of technical applications of if you are doing a project, how to do it well. If they don't do that, we appeal. And we have a process where we can do that administratively and then ultimately can go through a court system. And so we do that. So our day, my day is, you know, full of whether it's permit review, outreach to agencies. And, you know, I wish I could say that we see the problem vastly improving. I think we hold the line. And we certainly have plenty of times where there might be a permit. This is a good example. A couple of weeks ago, where there was a bulkhead proposal in, I think, off Camino, new 200-foot bulkhead that they just allowed to go in with no mitigation. And had we not been there to see that and step up with a polite voice to say that is not what the law says, that would have gone through with all of the impacts and no mitigation, because we stepped in. That project had to change, has to do mitigation, things like that. So that's a really crunch of our day in and day out.
All right. Truman, I think you had a question.
Yeah. I thank you for that example, because that's what I was going to ask. What kind of permits are we talking about? Are we talking about septic? Are we talking about, you know, bulkheads, or what? What are the permits that come up?
That's a great question. So the hydraulic code, the HPA permits is just in water or sort of adjacent at the shoreline there. Rarely does it go above the high water line. So because every permit in this under state law, any kind of use that diverts the water or uses it requires this permit. We see everything from mooring buoys, bulkheads, docks, floats, you name it, any kind of anything that you're seeing. And sometimes there'll be smaller things, dredging you know, pretty much anything that sort of running joke is if your feet are going to get wet doing it, it requires an HPA.
Well, so what I'm wondering is how about, I mean, we have wetlands in inland that affect the sound. So are you looking at those things as well, the changes upriver or upstream?
So we do not. So the hydraulic code actually does apply also to freshwater, to streams, but our expertise is marine. And so so we do not do our same watchdog work on the freshwater systems. There are some organizations that do it a little bit more piecemeal. They might look project to project or somewhat in their area, but the law does apply because, yes, of course, there's that connectivity. But we basically try to protect those little salmon when they come out of the stream.
Okay. Craig.
So, Amy, thanks for being here. The new dock at Tramp Harbor would be the kind of thing that would require a permit, would it not?
Yes.
Okay.
It would require, so we look at one of the permits. We also sometimes look at some of the other layers. Anything needs a local permit, a state permit, and a federal permit.
Okay. Have you taken a position at all on that dock?
I don't know that we've taken a position. And honestly, for Sound Action, you know, the goal is not stop all development. I mean, we have to change the pace of it. We have to grow up and say no to things, right? People don't get to have, with the state of decline of what we're looking at with southern residents, with salmon, with Puget Sound, you know. And so there is that issue. But as critically important as then, and when you are doing something to make sure that you're following the laws and then you're not causing impact. And overwater structures like that are incredibly damaging. People don't quite realize that connection because they seem sort of like this picturesque thing. They're interesting. You can look down and see fish. But the reality is it's what's happening below the waterline can be a very different thing. So I think we advocate for, in a situation like that, it's also a very large overwater structure of, are there alternatives? And if it is something that moves forward, that you're making sure that you're not damaging kelp and eelgrass and forage fish spawning and things like that.
So one of the things that that I find interesting, the I'm going to lose my train of thought. Oh, my gosh. Don't tell me.
Well, I can jump right in and it'll come back to you.
Thank you.
Because I was going to ask Amy of what, you know, of these issues that, you know, that you just mentioned, this notion of shadowing, is what are the type of most common issues that you discover in this permit review process?
Well, you know, for each different kind of development project, there's a pretty good subset of known impacts. So, and there's kind of an unfortunate lather, rinse, repeat on that throughout the Salish Sea, right? So bulkheads, for example, can have really damaging impacts to forage fish spawning beaches. Forage fish are the sand lance or the surf smelt. And that becomes, they spawn very, very high up on the tide there. And so when you're building bulkheads, you're not only, for example, just excluding them from an area where they might have otherwise been spawning, or you're changing some of the sedimentation rate that is really important. This sounds funny. It goes down to the grain of sand, right? Surf smelt and sand lance need a specific type of beach composition. And so bulkheads have very distinct impacts on that. Overwater structures, the shade impact is very significant. That will shade out both native vegetation that might be there, kelp or eelgrass. I think one of the impacts that folks may not think of as obvious, but it's very pronounced, is there's an impact to juvenile salmon that are trying to migrate or forage. They avoid shaded areas and a light dark interface, right, where it goes from daylight to that dark. And so you're not allowing them to use that space with a dock, for example. And then to when they're coming and sort of migrating through the very upper near shore areas there, if they hit that dark space of a dock, they won't go under it most of the time. And so then they have to travel all the way out into that deeper water, which can increase predation of juvenile salmon, changes more energy. I mean, very few juvenile salmon make it out of Puget Sound alive. So that's a very real impact of all of these overwater structures there. And of course, even if you're looking that they can't go in that dock area, or what, when somebody puts a new dock in, it removes, they can't go and feed in that same area at this very, very critical life stage. So it might seem like there are these somewhat, because they're smaller, right? They're not as big and scary as barging operations or industrial ports, but the damage, and certainly collectively, is really what the issue is.
All right. Truman, I heard the train whistle of your thought coming back.
Yeah, it went bling, came back. You know, one of those. What I was going to say is, when you were talking about the bulkhead up on Kameno, I think, one of the things that you talked about was mitigation, and that after, I mean, you didn't stop the bulkhead. You came up with a way to mitigate the damage that was being done. And I was very heartened by that. And I'm wondering, is that something that you try to do, is to come up with mitigations for those issues, or just stop them?
Well, I wish I had the magic wand to have appropriate mitigation. That's a whole other thing. Because the reality is we also can't mitigate our way out of this.
Right.
And so, you know, there's, I don't think there's any one answer that is the sort of how you fix all of this, other than the application of environmental laws in a robust way. We also work quite a bit on improving those laws, or sometimes defending. So we do policy work as well in Olympia every year. And I raise that because it kind of has a tie-in, like with shoreline armoring bulkheads. There are going to be some times and places that they are absolutely necessary. somebody's house is about to go over the bluff, something like that. It can be frustrating because it's one thing when it's somebody built their house 40 years ago and we didn't know better. It gets a little steam coming out of my ears when it's the person who built their house 5 years ago, because the damage is so high. But there's a process now, in part because of some work that we did, where if you're having an erosion issue, that you are first required to have what they'll call a needs analysis. Like, what's really the problem? Is it really a problem? Are you just, afraid that it might be? And what's the solution? Because oftentimes it's the drainage that, you know, we put our big lawns on top of a slope and let the water all go over the edge. So how do you address that? And we'll call that a needs analysis. And then if you do have an issue, what's the lightest touch you can take there? You can do plantings, you can do soft shore armoring, which is more using, I'm trying to mimic a little bit more of a natural process, with hard armoring being the worst. Those cement or rock hard armors are the worst. And so there's you would look at that. What does the needs analysis say? Was it done appropriately? And did they use the least impacting? And then from there, if it is a yes, there did need to be armoring and this is what it was, then what are the impacts and how do you get to a place where the goal is that you are truly, truly mitigating for that loss? That's what the process should look like. We've worked to put those tools in place with the law and we will be there to sort of fight for their application, but we're still losing ground all the time because the agencies are there's a very deep problem there. And so, we're slowly working to fix it, but those are the issues that we see every day.
All right. Yeah, Bruce, I think you had a question.
Yeah, Amy, thanks for being here. with Preserver Islands, there was a real clear metric of success. It basically stopped the gravel pit and, the land became a public park and part of King County. I mean, so it was a real clear and it is a magnificent sort of example of a community coming together to achieve an objective. With your work, what are the metrics? You're never going to be able to pack up and go away.
I'd love to be out of a job.
Yeah, right.
That's a great question because it's something that you're right. There's a sort of different lens on this. What does success look like? What are the goals? And of course we can do all that stuff. We have strategic plans and we can identify them, but by the very nature of regulatory watchdog, it's not as specific as this one project and this one thing. So there's often layers of how I think we can look to have some measurement of stuff. Certainly we can sometimes have those cases like I just described that was real life of that, 180 foot bulkhead where that was an immediate shift and an immediate habitat protection. I think that we can have some similar work when, if we're going to Olympia, for example, or we're changing laws or drafting laws and they pass, great. You can look at that was a success, but then there's the application of it, which can still get a little bit messy. This is hard. There are days where you're just, it feels like it's one step up and 20 steps back. But then we'll have these reminders come forward. And I'll share an example because I think this goes to show a little bit to that answer of a different kind of metric. Even in the face of sometimes when you didn't feel like you were making progress. And so, I talked a little bit about forage fish and we talk about them a lot because they're the backbone of a healthy Puget Sound. If you care about orcas, you have to care about the sand on the beach and forage fish. And when we first started doing this work, and really kind of in the heart of 2014, when we had some different access to the permit database, we saw, areas where forage fish spawn, they'll call them documented forage fish spawning habitats, are in state law designed to be given some additional level of protections. But the agency was taking this very narrow focus that unless somebody had at some point in time done a forage fish spawning survey, found what their nearly microscopic eggs in that sample, And then they would kind of throw this random, okay, if we found eggs, let's just call it 1,000 feet is where they're spawning. That's the area we're going to protect. And when we started doing this, I was surprised that they were like literally had a line in the sand. If there was a project 10 feet away from where that very arbitrary 1,000 feet line was, and it was 1,000 feet from the egg, so, you know, it wasn't even, there was 1,000 feet total, they would not apply the protections. And so, you know, we learned a lot of tenacity at Preserver Islands. And so we would just keep appealing the same issue over and over and over, by the way. And I'd bring the maps out like, here's this, here's this, here's this. And we would have them all turned back like, nope, nope, nope. And these are administrative appeals. And so, you know, it was I lost count how many times. And then we had their science team, who was not a part of their regulatory team, get a little bit of wind of this, because we kept saying, this is arbitrary. What are you doing? This is, you know, this is just, there's not based on science. And their science team actually wrote a policy to the head of the department saying, I'm looking at this because of third party appeals. Mm-hmm. And they're right. Now, being a little more grandiose on the language. And I shared that as an example. So when that happened, because we just kept hitting on that issue, the agency, then the Department of Fish and Wildlife and their science team now said, we better figure out what this real, you know, what is not arbitrary, what is really sort of the science-based supplement there. And so they did a lot of internal work and determined that instead of it being this sort of 1,000 feet total, I'm going to cross measurement units now, they went to 1.2 kilometers.
Wow.
And they went and applied it retroactively. So every point that had previously had this 1,000 feet on it now had 1.2 kilometers of documented habitat that's intended to be protected. And so that was huge. You could see, we use GIS mapping on all of these data layers, and I happen to use blue for surf smelt spawning. And so you could look then back in areas where, after they adopted that, and we were a part of the adoption in the policy of it too, after that was adopted, you could go the next day and see what was an area that had maybe some sketch of blue lines was all blue. Just the whole thing was all now habitat protection. That was really significant. And I think a good example of how important work like this is and the difference that it can make. And then we sort of leveraged that by starting to do work in Olympia to help fund forage fish spawning surveys now every year and throughout the sound and in a different way. So it compounds upon itself in the best way of improving that and then bringing in the tools to expand on that as well. So on my dark days, I remember those.
All right. Amy, I'm glad you mentioned the nuance here, because I think having spent a little bit of time in that world myself, you know, there's one thing to pass a law and the legislature can say, yes, we did. And then it's another thing to actually how that law gets applied, right? Mm-hmm. And your insights there into these are some of the challenges, I suspect, that I'm glad you brought to light here as we're talking. I am curious, you did mention that every year you do legislative advocacy. What's at the top of your list for the upcoming 2023 legislative session, or is that still something in development?
I'm thrilled to share it because I'm really excited about it. And it's sort of a reboot. So, and every year when we go into this, we don't just say, hey, like, let's do something fun. We try to look strategically what's going to give us, you know, the sort of greater good and cause, the most leverage points, what's information, how do we improve that? And so one of a real gap information wise is there's not this very good baseline, you would think there would be, of the Salish Sea. What's going on? Where are intact habitats still? What's the right level of that really is armored or not? Nobody has any real answer on that. They can guess. And so we have long held sort of I have this dream of I keep calling it the Google Street View for Puget Sound. And so that we drafted, working with Senator Solomon, who is, I forget which district Senator Solomon is, Seattle. Because again, we work system wide, and I live here, but the board and our organization is statewide. And so we put together last year, this, we call it a Saving Salmon, Saving Orcas package that we're rebooting this year, of calling then for the State Department of Ecology to do these boat-based Google Street Views of the entire Salish Sea. And using technology now, too, we have so many better tools that basically would allow an entire inventory of what's there, what condition is it in, are there areas where there's debris piling up, where are some really great mitigation opportunities. So that's a key focus of the legislation we'll be working on this year, combined with, they call them oblique aerials, but they're a specialized kind of aerial view that gives you sort of the two looks at that same package. And that becomes important, not just because it's fun, but the value in that, where you could have agencies, tribes, nonprofits, citizen groups, having this access to really valuable information, and then continuing that every 2 years. So we're getting an actual baseline and maintaining that baseline using this level of technology. So that's what we're doing in 2023. We passed through the Senate last year, got stuck in the House because the people who are not Democrats decided to target us. But I think we're pretty confident for this session. And they shift around a little bit, but that's the goal for 2023.
All right, Truman.
Yeah, I have two questions. One's technical, one is not. The technical one is, you were talking about the shading and the effect. Years ago, when I was working with forest stewards, we worked with the land trust to bring in stumps and logs and things to put in the shingle mill and to improve the habitat. And I'm curious how that works. I mean, I assumed that it was to shade some of it into.
Yeah.
So is that, what's the technical benefit there?
It's good in freshwater, not good in Salish Sea.
Okay.
And so, but that's a great point. So when you're looking in those freshwater systems, there's different needs for the salmon there, and cool water is very, very important for them. And obviously, if you were shading an entire stream out, you'd have an issue and a problem.
Right.
But no, so that shading resource is incredibly valuable and necessary in the upland areas. There's even a little bit of natural shading thing that can be helpful for marine habitats, those forage fish eggs. When you have the overhanging vegetation there and the trees, you know, native trees and plants along the shoreline there, that kind of natural shading is good. It's very limited. And it's not this sort of very dark contrast shade. But that's a great question, because yes, shade good in freshwater, not good in the marine.
That's a great answer. I appreciate that. My other question is funding. What is your funding source, and how does that work?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We're, as a nonprofit 501c3, we do this work in partnership with donors and some foundations. And so we are people powered. And the donations that come in go, we have very little overhead. We tend to be a pretty lean operating organization. And so, you know, we have to spend part of our year, like every other nonprofit out there, asking folks to join us in this work by making donations. And I'm really grateful for the people who do step up and help us with this.
All right. Fantastic. Yeah, Amy, I'm curious, you know, you do focus on permits and that's, of course, across the state, as you mentioned, but our shoreline waterfront property owners here on Vashon Maury Islands, is there anything you'd like to leave with them about what they can do to protect nearshore habitat?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because Vashon is this very, in some ways, a bit of an oasis. In we have a lot of really vital, intact habitat. And what we do here matters not just for, you know, I mean, Puget Sound's everybody's backyard. So what we do here matters not just for that direct impact we might have on a beach here, but it impacts the juvenile salmon that come to Vashon come from all over Puget Sound and the Salish Sea. And so really, I think I would always encourage shoreline property owners to take some opportunity to really learn about what's happening there on their properties and how they can support those ecosystems and restorations. Really think hard about building a bulkhead. Think even harder about removing the one that you have. That's a huge benefit. Oftentimes people don't need them anymore. And the same thing I would say goes for overwater structures. Everything that you do, there's nothing that's benign. So I think having a mindfulness on that and learning about those impacts and helping to really steward, you know, this, you know, abundance that is, you know, if you're a property owner, that's the shoreline property at your feet.
Mm-hmm. But, right. By the way, I will comment. I will comment that I've had some folks telling me about going down to Shingle Mill and seeing the salmon run, and that it's pretty spectacular this year. We got a lot of fish coming up.
It is. I went last week. The southern resident orcas they come down here in the fall and winter, and so they were down last week, and they did a they ditched us. They did a turn and burn at the north end. Yeah. And I was out in the morning and bundled up, and I said, well, if I'm not seeing orcas today, I'm going to go see why they're down here. Yeah. And so I went over to the Shingle Mill, and it was great. There was
a lot of salmon.
You know, yeah. So good work, Truman, on those
logs, right? Yeah.
But that shows you how important that is, right? So here's something you did how many years ago? You might look at it and say,
I don't know. 10 years ago.
Yeah. Does this matter? It matters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. So, Amy, you've given some really great suggestions for how people can become more aware. How do people get more involved or learn more about the work of Sound Action?
Well, I think our website is a great place to start, and that's soundaction.org. We also, social media, we have a Facebook page that's also, I think it's Sound Action NW, but you'll find us there. Anybody can always reach me directly, info@soundaction.org. Always happy to talk to folks, whether they're regional issues, local issues.
Fantastic. And I will just say that I will love to follow up with you about a 2023 legislative session. There's a few opportunities I think we can help to raise awareness about the work you're doing. So
that's great. I'd appreciate that.
Touching base with you. Craig, did you have a comment?
No, my comment was just a thank you. I wanted to thank Amy for all of the work she's done on Vashon over many years. For fish and mammals in the sound, as well as mammals and people's pets on the island, kind of the go-to person that may wake you up in the middle of the night on quite a few occasions, Amy, but we really appreciate all the work you've done.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for that. And I'm just grateful to be in this really awesome community where nothing that I do is alone. It's all partnership. And sometimes I might just be the face of it, but there's 20 people behind doing the same work with me. So it's pretty remarkable to be able to have these opportunities at the same time.
Mm-hmm. You're here. Truman, go ahead.
Oh, just one quick thing. I just looked at your website. Wow. Beautiful. That is really a fantastic website. When you zoom in, you can click on any of these number of dots that tells you what permitting is happening, who owns the property. I mean, the whole works. Very, very good. Yeah. Good job.
And that shows you that map there. And it's a feed that comes in directly from the DFW permitting system. That is every so then look at every one of those dots, and I've reviewed them. But yeah, it goes to show you how vast the issue is too.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Amy, we certainly invite you to stay for the rest of the show. We're going to be diving into some local issues, some national issues, and some international issues. So Love to, if you'd like to share your thoughts with us on those.
I would be happy to.
All right. Well, the next one actually was if anybody wants to add any additional comments to the Tramp Harbor Dock, because I think, Bruce, did I see a recent article that you and Terry Donnelly put together on the dock?
You did. Yeah, we've been researching that dock. Actually, when we started the Ellisport History Project, almost 10 years ago now, we were looking at all the docks in Tramp Harbor. And actually, you know, there were four different docks in Ellisport, and the Standard Oil Dock and the old ferry dock at Portage, you know, which was right to the south of it. And just trying to identify where those docks are and when they were there, it was really fascinating. And what we found is that the old ferry dock from Portage, so the first automobile ferry on the island ran from Portage to Des Moines. It was from 1916 to 1922. And during that time, it was right to the south of the Tramp Harbor fishing pier. I have always thought it was further south than that. And Carlista Rickardson, who is a diver here on the island, her son actually found the old pilings that they'd cut off. So we went out and mapped that old dock. And it's really fascinating. I mean, it was a very shallow dock. I mean, very close to the shore compared to the fishing pier. I mean, the fishing pier is, what, 340 feet long or something like that. It's a pretty amazing sort of fishing pier. And as Amy said, it has a huge impact on that area. So what we've done is just trying to identify what's going on there and identify Park District's trying to deal with this too, where the tribal fishing rights are in that area. And so that all goes into play. And Amy, you work with this all the time. There's sort of overlapping responsibilities and overlapping interests. And how do you negotiate through those and navigate through those? And I think that's what's going to happen with the Tramp Harbor Fishing Pier. Hopefully, you know, as a recreational kind of thing, hopefully it's rebuilt, but hopefully it's rebuilt in a responsible way, in a way that sort of protects the beach and doesn't protrude out into the native fishing areas.
Mm-hmm. All right. And there's other infrastructure that you're involved with, Bruce, with shedding some light on the Portage store, which is for sale.
Oh, that's an interesting one. It's essentially that property. The whole salt marsh there is basically for sale. So there's three parcels really that go together. And I think the most encouraging thing about it is there's a coalition sort of working. Amy, you know how coalitions work. It really becomes that it adds some oomph to whatever's going on. But King County is very interested because of the roadways and because they're going to need to change the roadways. You know, the land trust is interested. Historic Seattle is interested in the store as a historic building. And a group of developers in Seattle who are interested, who have restored the Sorrento Hotel and the University Bank building on University and 45th. And so there's a players at work here that I think we'll find ultimately a solution. And as Amy Weld knows, with the glacier sort of fight, it takes time and it takes energy and it takes getting people together to sit down at a table and talk.
All right. So lots of things happening on Vashon. Let's see, unless any other comment on that nationally. There's a recent article about the elections, the midterms, that America dodged an arrow. And Craig, you comment, or Bruce, I'm sorry, you comment a little bit earlier about, you know, whether this might be an indicator of American politics in an inflection point, a turning point. Do you think that's true, or do you think you see a blip on the trend?
Well, it turned the wave into the ripple, as we talked about earlier. And so yes. I think it's significant. I think the election's very significant. You know, what's more significant is what's going to happen in Georgia and then what's going to happen in 2024. But it's certainly an indicator of that sort of a rush to the right and a rush to autocracy that we saw going on for the last, 6 years, is starting to subside somewhat, or at least being held at bay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Craig, what are your thoughts?
Well, rumors of the demise of our past president, I think, may be greatly exaggerated by some. You hear a lot about the Republican Party's in turmoil, and other people are starting to speak up. Former Vice President Pence is now hinting pretty strongly of his distaste for his partner in the White House, but that could change in a heartbeat. The problem that I see with regards to putting ex-President Trump in the rearview mirror is that he, I think, would very quickly, if he was abandoned by the Republican Party, run by himself, and that would basically destroy, pretty well destroy the Republican Party's effort to win the presidency in the next election. If you had a three-way between Trump, the Republican Party, and the Democrats. So, watch this space.
Michelle.
Yes. You know, Craig, the Department of Justice has been relatively quiet this last month, and we understand they don't want to tread on any of the election work. Some are saying that we're going to see the Department of Justice expose some of the things they've been working on over the last month, pretty quickly now. But now there's a Georgia runoff race. What do you think? Is the DOJ going to have to sit back for another month?
No, I don't think so. The Department of Justice and Merrick Garland are clearly conscious of some of the political aspects of their movements. There are individuals who say, they can't do anything until the Georgia race is over, and then they can't do anything once Donald Trump announces again, like we're expecting him to do this afternoon, that he's running. None of that's true. They can carry on without a special prosecutor. There's no immunity for an ex-president from being investigated and prosecuted. And I think that, Merrick Garland is just, he's careful. He rarely loses cases that he brings. In some instances, he never loses cases that he brings. I think that they're proceeding. There are often times when we have a friend or not a friend, but we have an enemy. Somebody who we don't care much for, and we go, everybody knows that person should be in jail, or everybody knows that, it doesn't, that's not the way the American justice system works. You got to have your case locked down, and you got to keep it fairly simple. You got to hone all those facts and all that evidence and focus on what you really think is going to win. And that's what I think is going on at the Department of Justice.
Mm-hmm. The wheels of justice, so we spoken of earlier on the show.
Grinding slowly.
Well, you'd want that if you were the subject of the investigation.
Absolutely. Grind slowly, indeed.
Right. Well, I'll have to inject that thank goodness that running for office does not create immunity for prosecution, because every crook in the country would obviously want to then run for office. Wouldn't that be a great system?
Yep. Safe harbor. Run for office.
Yeah. We had an interesting thing happen. I live at Ellisport at KVI Beach. And Amy, you'd be pleased to hear this. I've lived here for 40 years. And you rarely see orcas in Tramp Harbor. They generally come down and they head over toward Three Tree Point and then toward Point Robinson, out in the deep water. But this past week, last week, we had a whole pod came into Tramp Harbor. It was just magnificent to see them in the harbor, and going along KVI Beach. And so it's always very encouraging, and they are magnificent to watch. Mm-hmm. But it's also interesting to realize how truly threatened they are. And that's where your work, Amy, is just so important.
Yeah, it is that great reminder. I'm glad you got to see them. We actually had a super pod last week. All three pods were in the central Puget Sound region. They didn't all come down all the way to Vashon, but it is always that great reminder too of They're so iconic for that of all that's on the line. And I don't think it could get more at risk than, I mean, you had endangered species that are on the top priority of endangered species. There's 9 species that they'll call species of concern because they're so close to being extinct. That's what to see that really brings that, both the amazingness of watching the animals and I think the recognition of what's on the line and how cool is it that Vashon is part of their survival, really, their story.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Craig, did I see it? Yeah.
You did see a hand, and I don't mean to change to a negative subject at the last couple minutes of our show, but... newsflash, some of you may have seen this, the Russians sent some missiles off that landed in Poland here in the last hour or two.
No.
And you don't want to bristle the Polish population. That's not a good thing, and I'm not exactly sure. I hope everybody keeps their head about them and the Russians don't do that again, to put it lightly.
So, Craig, NATO has something called Article 5, and for our listeners who don't know what that is, it means that any NATO nation that gets attacked, the other NATO nations will come to their defense. And the only time that it's actually been invoked in the history of the alliance is when we had our 9/11 attack by terrorists, in which case NATO flew air traffic control AWACS aircraft over our country to help us through that period. So given the news that you just mentioned, is your expectation that Article 5 is now in play?
I think so. The fact that it's in play doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to be bombing Russia back, but it certainly means that they're going to be sitting down and talking with one another, and which they've been doing, the NATO forces. It's the atomic clock ticking a little closer to midnight.
I'm looking online right now, and it just says the White House official can't confirm reports of a Poland missile explosion. So,
well, I said it, so it must be true.
Yeah.
No, you heard it on the radio.
I heard it
on NBC. So that's my source. So that's good. Maybe it's not. The case, or maybe it's close. That Polish border keeps moving. You know, it's an elusive border.
Well, Truman, I would like to ask you. I know that you're maybe not a military strategist, but who knows? Given the paperwork you had to fill out at one time, what would you be thinking about the Russian invasion of Ukraine at this point? Now that Kherson has fallen, and it looks like the Russians are in retreat.
Well, I started out before the Russians even moved in there. We were talking about this, and I said that I was in Germany when the Russians invaded Czechoslovakia, and they did not do it the way that they did not attack Ukraine the way they did then. And it really surprised me, to tell you the truth, that it stalled, their assault stalled as it did. Because in the past, what they would do is they would close down all the roads and they would roll the roads full of tanks and artillery, and they would roll them at speed. And they would only stop every 2 hours to refuel and grab a bucket of borscht and a chunk of bread, and then they were gone. I mean, these guys moved. They did not do that here, and I think it's just reflects on the decline of the Russian army, basically.
Mm-hmm. Craig,
I heard one other thing on the internet. But the thing I heard on the internet was that Putin delayed the retreat from Kherson until after the midterm election, thinking that that somehow would affect the announcement earlier, would affect who people in the United States voted for. I think he gives our voters a little more credit than perhaps they deserve. But that was a strategic move, I understand, on his part.
Well, thank goodness the election did turn out the way it was. And let's see, I think we're hearing those foghorns. So in closing, for Amy and Bruce, Truman, Craig, and I, Kevin Jones, we hope you'll visit us next Tuesday. Next Tuesday is the first Brown Briefly reunion show. So Susan McCabe, Lynn Kerrigan, Gail Kellner, Michael Shook, and Truman, Bruce, Craig, and myself. and perhaps a special guest will join us. So I hope you'll tune in next Tuesday. Thank you again, Amy, for joining us. It's been
Thanks
such a pleasure to have
me.
You here.
I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.